Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
From KQED. Hey everyone, from KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos.
And I'm Guy Marzorati, in this week for Scott Schaefer. And today on The Breakdown, we have a twofer, end-of-session download with an assemblywoman who made national headlines this week, and a conversation with a man who spent years in prison for a murder he didn't commit, but is now endorsing the prosecutor who sent him there.
That's right. We'll talk to Jamal Truelove about why he threw his support behind Kamala Harris and, of course, Joe Biden. But as well as that incredible film he starred in, The Last Black Man in San Francisco. But first, Assemblywoman Buffy Wicks is here now. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. I love your guys' show.
So you had quite the week. I mean, all 120 members of the legislature, I guess, had some sort of week. But yours was particularly interesting to us because a tweet you put out with you holding your three-week-old baby in a, I don't know, was that an Ergo or a baby Bjorn?
Well, four weeks old.
4 weeks old.
And there's a baby Bjorn, yep.
Baby Bjorn. So you were in the state capitol with your newborn baby. You had been denied a request to vote by proxy. This is a system only, sort of a nascent system being set up because of the COVID pandemic. Can you talk about, like, go back a little bit, talk about your week. I mean, when did you realize that you were going to have to essentially put your family at risk to do your job and vote on these critical end of session bills this week?
Yeah, it was last Friday. And I knew Sunday and Monday we'd be voting on the sort of end of session stuff. And as you all know, at midnight on the 31st, the bills turn into pumpkins and die for the year. So there's going to be a lot of stuff coming through the last couple days here. I thought I was going to be able to proxy vote for a little while and then was told, actually, I don't qualify. And so I'd actually told colleagues I'd be voting on their bills. And I knew we had the plastics bill, the family leave bill, the housing bill, the evictions bill. So there's a lot of tough bills coming up. And I care about those issues, you know, and my district cares about them tremendously. So over the weekend, I basically had to decide, do I just stay home with my four-week-old and continue to nurse her every 2 or 3 hours and be a mom and kind of call it a day and continue to stay on leave? Or do I schlep to the Capitol? And if I do I bring her with me? And so my husband and I talked about it over the weekend, and I ultimately decided to bring her with me because we're nursing. And she's been with me every single day since she was born, and obviously the 10 months prior to that inside of me. So we decided to bring her with me. And so that Monday morning, I packed up all the accoutrement for a 8-pound little girl, and which is vast, as anyone knows, and drove up to Sacramento and was, you know, there all day and late into the night with my daughter.
I mean, how worried were you before we get into the debate over proxy voting and some of the bills, but just about your safety, her safety? I mean, the reason proxy voting had been set up at all was because of COVID-19 for people who were high risk. I think being pregnant could have qualified for that. I feel like being postpartum just for you, and then obviously bringing an infant who has no immunity really to anything.
I was very worried about it. I continue to be worried about it, you know, and I had a C-section as well. So recovering from that. And that's why I asked for a proxy vote, you know, is I'm post C-section. She's 4 weeks old. Her immune system, she hasn't had her vaccines yet. Obviously there's not one for COVID, but like all the other things as well that you don't want to expose your infant to. And so we also decided I would spend the majority of my time in my office. I didn't want to be on the floor. There's about any given moment, there's about 100 people on the floor for hours on end, breathing the same kind of air. And I was like, I don't want to do that. So I spent the majority of my time in my office, and I really only came down a couple times. One of which was when I spoke, and was very quick in and out when I was there. And I had her covered up because I didn't want like people breathing droplets on her. And, you know, and I know that it can't really guard that much on the aerosol front, but like I was trying to do anything I could to sort of, you know, keep it as safe as I possibly could.
Yeah.
Now, the speaker, Anthony Rennan, has apologized after this incident, but he didn't really address how rules are going to change. This could still be an issue when the legislature returns. You know, COVID is not going away anytime soon. Generally, when it comes to this remote voting, and then more specifically how the legislature is dealing with working parents, You know, what do you think needs to change?
Well, we've had a lot. I've spoken to the speaker about this quite a bit and have been talking to him throughout all of this, you know, and I think he's committed to, and certainly I am, to revisiting the remote participation policy that we have. And I think there's a separate conversation around what are kind of workplace flexibility for parents. And it's sort of a newer thing. And frankly, I mean, 30, 40 years ago, the body looked very different. Now you have, I've got two young ones, Rebecca Bauer Cahan has little kids. Jesse Gabriel just had a little boy about a month before me. Sabrina Cervantes had triplets last year. You know, Monique Lamone is pregnant. She's going to be over in the Senate, you know? So I think it's a newer thing to have younger parents there, which is very exciting. And I think the body needs to evolve and we need to figure out. And I think there's a question on the table, like, you know, should part of maternity leave be remote participation so that I, as a legislator can still vote for bills that my constituents care about while I take leave? Or are some, or do we not do that because we should respect that leave, you know? Mm. And so I think those are, or do we make it an option for legislators, right? Mm. So I think there's a lot of questions that need to be fleshed out. I think this moment will allow for that. But I think the bigger issue, frankly, and this is why I think this issue went so, the sort of image of me with my daughter on the floor went so viral, is that that is every working mother across this country, you know, who's experienced that moment where you're trying to like feed your kid and your other kid's crying and the phone's ringing and dinner's burning and whatever, or you got to get to a meeting and they're sick and you're just struggling with all of these things. And I think especially right now with COVID-19, where you have, you know, parents competing with their kids for, you know, the computer to do Zoom just as learning. And I mean, the world is madness right now. And the stress parents are under is enormous. And we're seeing increase in child abuse. I mean, all kinds of things, right? And so I think that's why that image of me speaking on the floor of struggling with like my mask and her and the blanket, and she's crying and I'm talking and I'm pleading and then I'm running out saying, I'm going to go, you know, finish breastfeeding my kid, I think spoke to people because everyone's experienced that. And I will say it's even worse for low-income communities who don't have the financial resources for it and all these other things, and particularly, you know, women of color. And so these are the things we need to look at coming out of this.
I mean, yeah, because you were lucky enough, I mean, lucky being in air quotes,
no,
because that you
privilege.
Could bring her at all,
right.
Even if it's unsafe. I mean, I do want to mention, actually, we had her on our show, I think last year, you know, the first person to ever give birth while serving as state lawmaker was Jackie Speier in California.
Yeah, right.
And she had to fight for everything. But I want to ask you, because there was this kind of like split screen weirdness happening. As you were on the floor, we had almost the entire Senate Republican caucus voting remotely because one of their members had tested positive for COVID, and apparently they had not followed social distancing guidelines, and most of the caucus had been together. And at the same time, as you mentioned, I mean, this is a progressive, democratically run legislature. You guys are voting on family leave policies for private businesses. Like, does it feel hypocritical that this is all happening kind of in the same time?
Well, you know, on the Senate piece, you know, they had their own process that you know, the pro tem had put forth. We had our own process for remote participation. Again, I think coming out of this, there's going to be a lot of lessons learned on both sides of how do we actually put forth flexible, like, ability to actually participate. And really, it's also a continuity of government question. And it's not just about COVID. If there's wildfires and earthquakes, like, we have to be able to have our government continue to function. So I think there's going to be more coming out of that. But they had a separate process that we didn't have. So I think there'd be more conversations. You know, on the other piece of it, sorry, what was the other question?
Oh, just about the idea that, like, the legislature is so reticent to change at the same time as they're happy to mandate that private businesses do.
Right. And we need to model the behavior that we want to see of people. You know, we need to model that behavior. But we also have to take those tough votes to allow for family leave. The fact that family leave passed by 41 votes, you know.
Passed
by one vote. Right. You need 41 votes to pass. Right. You know, it should be easier than that. You know, and I pressed the green button holding my daughter in my arms, you know, on that bill. And that's part of the reason I came to the Capitol. Mm-hmm. And, you know, had I not been there, would we have gotten it over the line? Maybe, but we might not have, you know. And so we have to both, I think, push for those types of policies, but also have them within our own body as well. And not just for members, but for staff.
We also want to talk a little bit about the bills that were on the floor as this was all going on. You mentioned the leave bill. You also went to the floor to vote for a bill regarding housing density, legalizing duplexes throughout the state. That bill kind of ran out of time, and there was a lot of back and forth between the two houses. I guess, you know, What's your take on how the process played out in those last few hours, as far as there was a lot of high-profile bills, whether on housing or criminal justice, where it kind of seemed as if either intra-house feuds kind of got in the way, and there wasn't the kind of management of the floor that allowed those issues to actually make it to the finish line?
Yeah. And, you know, I think part of it is this year has been insane with COVID. And, you know, we were out of session for, I don't know what it was, 2 months. And so we were missing those kind of key time to actually flesh your bill out. The bills go through these huge processes. They go through multiple committees, multiple floor votes. By the time they get to the end, they're much more kind of, I think, well developed and thought out. And so that was truncated. That whole process was very truncated. So I think that was a piece of what was going on. You know, frankly, I was spending the majority of my time that day in my office, like breastfeeding my daughter and changing her diapers and burping her and then running down to the floor and voting. And like, I wasn't sort of in tune to like all of the sort of back and forth of what was happening in terms of what bills were coming up. You know, and that's why when the housing bill that I spoke on came up, you know, we didn't know when it was going to come up. We knew it was close to midnight. We had to vote on that bill, get it done in our house and get it over to the Senate so that they could vote on it on concurrence and pass it before midnight. And I think it passed in our body like around what, 11:59 or 11:58 or something. It wasn't fast enough to get it to the Senate. And so while the bill passed in the Senate and passed in the Assembly, didn't make it back over to get voted in time. And so the bill died. And it was such a bummer. It was really, really such a bummer, you know, and I hope that like next year we can have, you know, and again, it's my first term, right? So I'm like fresh off the turnip truck here, right? Like in the legislature. So I'd never experienced end of session before. This was my first one. And I'm like, I don't know, maybe they're always like this. Is it always this crazy when you have like COVID and like newborns on the floor? Maybe, you know.
The pettiness is always there.
Yeah, the pettiness. Well, which brings me to another question. I mean, how much do you blame leadership, including the leader of your own house, Anthony Rendon? I mean, yes, you guys only have till midnight, but you had 8 months prior to this. And it seems like everyone always waits till the last minute to leverage each other and the bills and that have these weird feuds that, like, quite frankly, most Californians do not care about whether you're in the Senate or Assembly it's a Senate bill or an Assembly bill.
They don't care. They want stuff to get done. They want these, you know, they want us working for them and in a way that actually passes legislation. Absolutely. And that's what they should demand of us. You know, again, it was my first time in the ending of the second year. And so for me personally, you know, I got 7 bills to the governor's desk this year. And I was very intentional about having none of them come up on Monday. You know, I wanted everything to be done as far in advance as possible, because what ends up happening inevitably is this last day becomes this kind of like crazy day where, and especially when you have these really tough votes where members are getting worked by all these different sort of entities. For me, I just didn't want to get caught up in any of that. So I was like, let's get all of our bills out on Sunday. And I had colleagues present for me because I was home on leave. Some of the leadership was like, oh, do you want us to save your bills for Monday so that you can present them yourself? I'm like, nope. And I'm going to have my newborn with me. I don't want to be on that floor. I want those bills out. I want them off to the governor's desk. So just from my own perspective, I tried to get everything done prior because I knew it was just going to be crazy on Monday.
All right. Assemblywoman Buffy Wicks, we will let you get back to your family. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks so much.
Good to see you guys.
And we're going to go to break in a second. But Marisa, before we do, I do want to ask you about a big exclusive interview you had this week from Colusa County, none other than the former governor, Jerry Brown, to talk about upcoming criminal justice measure on the November ballot, Proposition 20. He's finally dipping into this war chest that he has to oppose some of these rollbacks on criminal justice. You know, what did you hear from him, and kind of what was his motivation in making this donation now?
Yeah, I mean, we've been kind of waiting to see if he would do this and expecting that he might. But, you know, Prop 20 has been put on by some police and prosecutors. It would roll back a bunch of the reforms that both voters and lawmakers have put into place to help kind of lower the prison and jail population in California. And they say give people a chance at rehabilitation and redemption. Brown is coming out of retirement a little bit. He's got almost $15 million still in his 2014. Campaign account. He's putting $1 million of that into defeating Prop 20. He says that he feels like voters will kind of see this for what it is. He actually accused DAs and police of kind of having a personal interest in keeping incarceration high to keep their jobs. Or maybe they just don't believe that people can change. But, you know, he was Jerry. He was a little grumpy. He was definitely straight to the point. And he seems really confident, Guy, that they're going to be able to defeat this and kind of keep a lot of those reforms that he helped champion.
What's interesting is that, you know, you mentioned Prop 20 is really going after two separate pushes on criminal justice reform. There was the 2014 reforms to change sentencing, and then this effort that Brown led in 2016 to change rules around parole. Do you have a sense about the Yes on 20 campaign? Are they focusing on more on the parole side of things, on the sentencing? Like, what's their message going into the fall?
Yeah, I mean, they are actually really focusing on Prop 57, which was the one that that Brown did write and push. And their message is, look, this promise that only nonviolent offenders would get early parole or the opportunity for early parole, because I think it's important to say there's no automatic release. They still go before this parole board. And they, you know, like to... Basically, you just read the list. They say, you know, domestic violence, sex trafficking of a minor are not included on this list. Now, what the other side says is, yeah, but most of those people are not, that's not the only thing they're in prison for.
Right.
And that information is before the parole board. They're not just like going into this blind. So I think they are really attacking Brown's legacy specifically. And I think he would have probably defended it anyway. But I think that has definitely made him a little more fired up than we might have seen.
Right. Well, we know no always starts out with an advantage over yes. And it yes. definitely seems even the yes folks in this campaign acknowledge they're probably going to go into the fall being outspent.
I think they will be outspent, and they're just hoping that voters are worried about violent crime. So we will see. We're going to take a short break now, Guy, and when we come back, we will be joined by actor Jamal Truelove. You are listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos here with Guy Marzorati, and our guest today is Jamal Truelove. He's an actor, musician, and activist who spent 6.5 years behind bars for a murder he did not commit. Jamal Truelove, welcome to The Breakdown.
Hey, thank you for having me.
I saw you jamming a little there. I think you might like... We got, like, that's like a endorsement from an actual musician, Guy. They like our music.
Everybody likes our music. Come on.
I was about to start freestyling. Walk-like type vibe.
So, Jamal, we really appreciate you being here. As I mentioned, you were tried and convicted of murder in 2010 in San Francisco. This was the killing of a young man at a public housing project where a friend of yours, actually. And from the start, you knew you were innocent of this crime. Was there a moment when you realized that you were going to be paying for something that you did not commit?
I fully realized it when I got sentenced. Didn't fully realize it even when I got convicted. Didn't fully realize it when, you know, I did my motion for a retrial before sentencing when I discovered Oliver Barcenas. But once I got sentenced, you know, I realized I had a fight on my hands.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, you know, through this whole time, there was all these holes that started emerging in your case, right? There was a man who overheard police talking about you with a witness, other informants telling police that you were innocent. Was this, you know, these little things that would pop up, was that providing you hope or making you think like, geez, this is even harder to bear?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Those are the things that definitely provided me hope to get to the next point of my case. So as those things developed, every time one came around, I felt like, okay, this is what's going to be it to that mm-hmm. ultimately was my towards my innocence, I get gets me back. And then it didn't happen. And then it I'll get that same notion, feeling like it's about to happen. Then it don't happen again, which ultimately, towards the end of everything, it all ended up playing a big part in bringing me home and also my civil case.
Yeah, I mean, we should say, I mean, this was everything from police officers essentially writing things down on the police report that weren't true, a prosecutor under Kamala Harris, and then George Gascon, an assistant prosecutor who essentially pushed this witness and gave her a lot of, you know, support and money to say that you, to ID you. And eventually you do get out. The conviction is overturned by an appeals court. You won a judgment from San Francisco. None of the police officers were ever fired. The prosecutor still has a job. I mean, the people who have paid are the taxpayers here. And yet, given all of that, you are supporting Kamala Harris and the Joe Biden ticket for president. Why?
Yeah, so it's not necessarily my support for Kamala, nor is it that much more my support for Biden, because I really don't... you know, agree with neither one of their pasts. It's more so the development of them and where they're going. And I think that they're more candidates that will listen and hopefully get us to a point where we could have an unapologetic Black agenda here in America. Donald Trump obviously is, you know, is Donald Trump. There's no haggling with him at all. A lot of this racism that's going on in this country today, people do credit him for bringing it out, which we've been experiencing it. So those are some pluses. And that's why some people, specifically Black people, will rather him actually stay in, because it's going to keep on bringing out all the nuances of racism in this country, so we could keep on talking about it, as bad as it is. And with Democrats being in office, typically people are looking at it like, you know, they're trying to have politics and things go the same way that they have been going for the past, you know, 400 years. But me, I just know, like, what we've been going through right now, we just want it to stop. We just want it to stop. We want people to listen to us much more, and I believe the Democratic Party in general will listen to us that much more than what the Republican Party actually will. And I'm not in a position to say that I'm going to hold my vote back and say I'm not going to vote or vote for just a party that has no opportunity to actually win the election. So me going for, you know, the Biden-Harris card is me, you know, just me going to say I'm going to vote, and I'm going to vote this way. I'm not going to vote that way, in hopes to start the conversation of, if I am going this way, these are the things that we would like to ultimately see when it comes to, you know, changing legislation unapologetically for Black people here in America, and also giving people opportunity to say who they're going to vote for. You know, I want to teach, you know, the youth that they have an opportunity to vote in the future, to use the vote, not to say that your vote doesn't count, not to say that you sit out of an election, because, you know, that's what ultimately happened 4 years ago, where people, you know, sat out the election, which ultimately got Donald Trump to where he is now.
Now, I've heard you talk about the day you were convicted, Kamala Harris, who was then district attorney, was in the courtroom. I'm wondering, has she ever reached out to her, to you, anybody in that office reached out to you just to apologize? And at this point, would it mean anything to you if they did?
Well, I mean, I believe it'd be huge. I mean, just that, I mean, that office right now is being ran by Chesa Boudin, you know, and, you know, I'm a good friend of mine. I campaigned for Chesa Boudin. He is what reform is today. He is, you know, to me, you know, our Bernie Sanders candidate here in San Francisco, you know, when it comes down to reforming this system. But pertaining to Kamala's office in those times, hey, look, Linda Allen, she ran the case back again. So, you know, I don't think there's any apologies coming from that side. And, you know, you let them tell it, I got away with murder. And they show no type of reconciliation or take no type of, you know, no type of responsibility at all of what actually happened. So if it was mentioned by Kamala, yes, absolutely. And it's not only me, there's other people that, you know, I'm vouching for and bringing home, you know, that has also fell under the watch of Kamala. But will I let my situation or someone's past, you know, hinder where we're going in this country? I don't think my situation is as big as this election.
Like, yeah, I mean, because you, in addition to the musician and acting and all those other things you're doing, have been really out here on protesting, helping lead some of the Black Lives Matter protest. And, you know, we're seeing those protests being used in this campaign against the left to say, oh, this is lawlessness, this is all these things. I'm just curious, like, do you think that folks you're talking to who are within that community understand the point you're making about the fact that, like, you know, basically don't make the perfect an enemy of the good? And I mean, how hopeful are you that given the sort of positions that Biden and Harris are taking, that they're going to get, especially young Black activists, to the polls at all?
Yeah, look, I hear in the streets and when I'm out in these protests that people are not voting. And that's what people, and that's not only Black people, that's anybody that comes out. And I've been at protests, you know, done spoke at protests, then led protests, and even on my social media. And, you know, I tell them, like, look, I'm the best way I can lead is to say, you know, use your voice, even if you're a Trump supporter, you know, say why you're voting for Trump, you know, and vocalize it so people could start getting a grasp of how this election ultimately is gonna look.
Right. You mentioned the protest. I think the last time I talked to you was at the George Floyd protests at the end of May, beginning of June. You've also been out recently. There's been some actions going on in Oakland following the shooting of Jacob Blake. Just talk to us a little bit about what you've seen as the protests have taken place this summer in the Bay Area. Any difference you noticed from what was going on a few months ago to now and kind of how you see that evolving?
Well, George Floyd was in that time when that happened, coming right after the pandemic and the lockdown, the media, the news forced it on everybody to actually see. And I think that had a lot of the protests had to do with a lot of people just finally seeing it because people had, it has been normalized. The numbers of, you know, African Americans that have been being killed, you know, wrongfully done by the police, and no police officers being charged. People wanted to get out. For one, they've been locked in for so long. Now it's time to get out. So yeah, it exploded, and then you get a Jacob Blake, and it one ups that. Like, you know, it's like and it's both, you know, tragedy is messed up. But then you see this officer shoot this Black man, you know, seven times in the back, you know, with no threat at all. And you would think that people will get right back out there again in the same magnitude that they did when you see George Floyd, you know, get choked out with the knee on his neck. And to be honest, I mean, I believe that, you know, that's almost where we got to get to again, because the message is not clear.
Jamal Truelove, thanks for joining
thank
us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for this edition of Political Breakdown. We are a production of KQED Public Radio.
Our engineer is Katie McMurrin. KQED's team includes Holly Kernan, Ethan Tovin-Lindsay, Vinny Tong, Erica Aguilar, and Jonathan Blakely. I'm Guy Marzorati. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Guy Marzorati.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. You can find me on Twitter at mlagos. Thanks for joining us.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.